change makers. You see them all around you. They're in your communities, your schools, your workplace. They do powerful things and they make change happen. In this series, we interview the many change makers who built up their policy toolkits at Princeton and went on to change their communities. These are their stories. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Changemakers. Today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Robert Gordon III. Rob has extensive senior management and cross-sector experience in the military, government, high-tech, and nonprofit sectors. He is currently the Chief Growth Officer of SBG Technology Solutions. Previously, Rob was Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Military, Community, and Family Policy in the Obama administration. Prior to his Pentagon appointment, he was the Senior Vice President and Chief People and Program Officer at CityYear. An airborne ranger, Rob completed a 26-year career in the U.S. Army, retiring at the rank of colonel. He earned his bachelor's degree from West Point and his MPA from the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. Well, thank you so much, Rob, for joining me today, and welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Thanks, Rose, for having me.
Okay, so we're going to start with a really big question. From your point of view and where you sit, what do you think is the most important policy issue facing us today?
There are a number of really important policy issues. One major one is the integration of technology with human relations. Technology continues to advance and evolve at a very rapid pace. Our policymaking process needs to keep pace with the evolution of technology. Artificial intelligence, drone tech, nanotechnology, I can list many technologies where we're just seeing rapid advancement. Part of that, of course, is the ethics of technology. What ought we pursue as a species, as a nation, with respect to continuing to increase the welfare function of the state? And some key decisions from policy leaders to policy analysts will be extremely important.
And these are a lot of the issues that you're working on as Chief Growth Officer at SBG Technology Solutions, right?
Yes, they are. We are a company that focuses on providing technologies and services to the federal government, everything from satellites to healthcare. I also involve myself, in addition to national security and health, to areas of growth like artificial intelligence and cyber. So these issues are very front and center for me and for our company.
Of all the issues that you're working on at the company, what project are you most excited about right now for this moment?
It is artificial intelligence and bringing artificial intelligence to the masses, democratizing artificial intelligence. And clearly, initially, we're focused on government. But this is a project and a vision that we want to bring even to education, some of our colleges and universities, nonprofits, small businesses. And undergirding this vision is the point that artificial intelligence has, first of all, not really been available to the masses, to many of our other sectors. It's been costly, requires very high human capital, and it takes a length of time from ideation through the deployment of AI. We have a dearth of people in this country, both who can do coding, but beyond that, be AI practitioners and know how to harness its power and to figure out the balance between machines and human beings in being able to improve organizational performance and even human performance as well. So we are embarked at the company SBG in creating training that focuses, because based on this training, you will require no coding and no programming skills to be able to build artificial intelligence and machine learning pipelines, and then develop use cases for your organization. We are focusing this training on that, coupled with the ethics of artificial intelligence and deeply thinking about the correct way of using it.
Can you give me sort of a concrete example of AI in the workplace or AI in schools, just to visualize it a bit more?
Yes, there's so many. I'm going to give you, AI in the workplace, the fact that you can have classification with respect in healthcare. Right. There's a great example that had occurred with the CEO of the AI company that we were working with. And he would be finding me sharing this story that his wife went in for a checkup, and it was determined by a surgeon that she had stage 4 cancer. They found 2 nodules, and the CEO and his wife had to make some quick decisions about whether to extract some of her lung. But after running the issue and using imagery data, a lot of it downloaded from the internet, the AI determined that she did not have cancer, that she had inhaled 2 oak spores, and those oak spores had calcified. And there was a way to tell in terms of an enzyme that was in her body. What a powerful example. They ended up, of course, not moving forward with the surgery, since the AI had predicted that there was an over 90% chance she did not have the cancer. What an example of the power of artificial intelligence to be able to make a classification like that.
So I'm thinking about all the people that are afraid of their data being tracked. So that's where this ethics portion comes in, I assume, right?
Yes. There are a couple of things about that. And there have been some very significant advances with respect to the sharing of data. First of all, oftentimes you anonymize data so that private information, PII, is not tracked or right. not even provided. That's first. But organizations are loath to even share data within their organization. A large government organization with many different directorates and sub-agencies oftentimes don't want to share data. And it's important to do so for prediction because they have mounds of data, both structured and unstructured. So what's the answer? The answer actually is what we call federated machine learning. You can actually export the AI model from data pool to data pool now without having to share the data for the artificial intelligence algorithms to be able to make their classifications and predictions. It's a big breakthrough because an impediment in the past to being able to come up with solutions based on data is that organizations don't like to share it.
Understood. I guess, could we pivot a little bit to your career? I'm just so curious. I mean, you've done so many things in your career and you're at this point now. Can you sort of, looking back at all of this, what are some of the more important skills and strategies you've learned along the way? And that's a very broad question, but I'm hoping you'll take it in a direction that you'd like to.
I've always been interested in the human condition. I am the son of an Army officer and an English teacher. First part of my life was spent overseas and not in the United States, the lion's share, Asia and Europe, Taiwan and Germany. I really had a chance as a young child to experience different cultures and come to terms with sort of the consistencies among cultures that you see, education and health and clearly safety and security. But mixed in all of that is this notion of a strong ethic of love and familial relationships and the ability to build vibrant community. And those are as important. If there was a thread through everything that I've done, it is about that. How do you improve the human condition? And then on top of that, how do you use new technologies to be able to do that, to be able to bring humans together in more powerful ways, to build trust? My strategy has evolved, sort of a multi-sector approach, primarily, public engagement and public policy and being in the public space and the public sphere. Everything from the military, of course, to serving in government, to serving in nonprofits as well, and technology organizations to achieve and hopefully play a small role in being able to improve humanity along the way.
Yeah, and I think part of that we're seeing now is, so many people have varying viewpoints, and it's really important to get those voices at the same table. And so my question for you on that is, when you're at a table with these varying viewpoints on an issue, how do you forge a consensus? What are some tips that you would offer young policymakers or others?
That's a very good question. Let me give you an example. When I was the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense, education fell under my purview. One of the issues was public schools on military installations. There are roughly 160 public schools on military installations across the country. Now, these are not schools within the defense system. The Department of Defense Educational Activity at the time had many schools. We clearly way over 100 schools across the world. 94,000 students, both here in the United States and abroad. But this school system, sort of school community, was different, these 160 public schools on military installations. And they had not been fixed in literally 50 years. They were public, so local school superintendents basically had purview all over these schools, but they sat on military installations, which means that the local commander also played a role in terms of those schools. It was quite a process to get people around the table, agree, first of all, on which schools needed to be fixed first, because the schools were owned by different organizations. The Department of Education had a stake, so did the Department of Defense, and clearly so did localities. You know, I ended up actually co-heading and then heading that initiative within the Department of Defense to find the money, prioritize the schools that needed to be fixed first, figure out a way to assess their condition and their capacity. And it was quite a policy problem set. So what I want to tell the audience is there are a number of different strategies. First of all, know who is around the table and who the decision makers are coming into the room. Now, I was one of those ultimate decision makers, but it involved the services, the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines. It involved superintendents. It involved congressional members because those schools were in their districts. You know, this is what we learn at the school too, right? Of actors coming to the table that would have influence on the decision. So first of all, know their stakes and stands. Secondly, be as inclusive as possible and as transparent as possible. And third, I would say, give people a stake in terms of a voice. And then finally, if you're a decision maker, make a decision.
Yeah.
When in charge, take charge. But make
Very
sure,
true.
You know, in this current environment in which we live, people's voices make a difference. Honor those voices and ensure that you recognize that they're meaningful voices in terms of what their stakes and stands are.
Well, it sounds like the school prepared you in some ways to make those comments. And I'm curious if we could talk a little bit more about the school
Yes. And
how it prepared you for your career more concretely.
Vital. Three ways. The first, clearly, I mean, the school has first-class professors, and the professors teach us. You know, the fact that Princeton requires our professors to teach the students, that's a big deal. Professor Bernanke was my macro P. Having access to some of the greatest minds who are really dedicated to teaching is instrumental in being able to be imbued with the kinds of skill sets and education, that abstract learning that is so important to being a policymaker or a policy analyst later. Second, the school has incredible students. So you learn as much from your fellow students as you do, clearly, from, you know, just or sitting in a classroom. So that mix of a great student body and great teaching, great professors has been instrumental. And then I'll tell you, because the school is small, it's intimate in terms of forging trust relationships, genuine friendships, and a vibrant relationship network, both among the professors and among the students and those supporting the university. The school does all three of those things. Great teaching, great professors, terrific student body, and developing a trust network because the school is small, and that's important.
And those networks really seem to last a lifetime from what I hear.
A lifetime. I mean, two of my closest friends are the godfather and mother of one of my sons.
Oh, wow.
They were, you know, my compadres and classmates at Princeton. So they do. They last a lifetime. Hey, we all had to get through the QE too.
That'll bond some people together.
It brings people together. It sure does.
Definitely. You know, I'm curious. I mean, you've had a lot of leadership roles, and I'm curious how you think the school trains students to be policy leaders or leaders in their own right. Maybe you could talk about some of the more tactical skills you gained at the school that you still sort of employ today.
Yeah, it supplanted leadership skills that were burnished in me at West Point. So I went to, of course, the United States Military Academy as an undergrad, and that is the premier leadership institution in the country, if not the world. Then going into the Army and becoming a leader at a very young age. I was commanding soldiers and equipment over in Germany at the age of 26. And, you know, that sort of leadership is something that the school then builds on as a result. So as we know, students at the school come from, you know, different experiences. For me, coming then to the school, being a part of some of those exercises that the school takes you through in terms of policy analysis and policy decision making is important. I remember one exercise I was playing the Secretary of Defense.
Oh, wow.
And I remember working with Professor John DiUlio, still a friend to this day, on my role. Well, my goodness, that ended up quite realistic, and the kinds of things I had to consider then.
Yeah.
And then, you know, going to become the Deputy Undersecretary of Defense, just valuable, just gold. A perfect example is, again, dealing with Congress. I went into my job and I was overseeing one program that before I got there ran out of money and shouldn't have. So here I am, the newly minted leader, Deputy Undersecretary of Defense. It was an education program for our junior military spouses so they could go on and then become certified and get jobs. It ran out of money and it shouldn't have. And I was called over to Congress on short order. And I'll always remember sitting in a room in Congress waiting for senior staff members. Maybe 20 minutes getting a chance to sort of think through what the heck I was about to say, given I was a newly minted, you know, deputy undersecretary. And this program had run out of money, and the school and its exercises helped me think through basically what I was about to say. First thing that I did when they came into the room was I apologized. You know, of course, I wasn't there. It wasn't under my watch, but now I'm in charge. So I apologize that the program didn't work out as they had intended. The second thing I did was I said, hey, look, I'm going to fix it. And here are a couple of ideas I've got. And the third thing, and the school imbues in you in terms of just the policy process. This gets beyond policy analysis to a policy process. How you incorporate actors and influencers in the policy process of getting things done is I asked them for their advice and said, look, I would like your advice. I would value it. And what I promise to do is continue to connect to you to get your advice on how we can make this program better. Those three things did work, and we were able to recraft that program into something very powerful, eventually called the Military Spouse Employment Partnership, which exists to this day, and we're very proud of it. My approach included the kinds of skills that I was imbued with while I was at the school.
What a perfect example. That's great. Thank you for sharing.
You bet.
We're just about out of time, so okay. I want to close it out with some advice from you to our young people or even those who are thinking about making a career switch or a job jump. How can those people be successful today?
There are so many challenges and opportunities. It's interesting as we look at this inflection point in which humanity is involved, this pandemic. It's across the world, regardless of where you are in the world right now. We are all going through the same thing. Pandemics and exogenous events like this are very defining. They pull back the covers on societies, and we're experiencing that right now in the United States in so many different ways. The covers are being pulled back. Are our systems really up to par? How about our political system? Is it vibrant, and can it take care of the American public, given this, you know, challenging pandemic that we have? Can it bring together people? Do we have the kinds of technologies in place to move forward beyond this? What about the public policy that I just talked about between technology and public policy making? It's a challenging and exciting time to be at the school, graduate from the school eventually, and then use the skill sets and the trust networks and the development, the personal development that happens while you're at the school, to be able to address some of these very big, gnarly, challenging issues to help move humanity forward. I think it's going to be an exciting time. Clearly, it's going to be a challenging time. But I know that what the school continues to do is find the best and the brightest and those who are focused on making humanity better and public life, that will be okay.
I have one follow-up question to that, which is, what do you think will be sort of forever changed by this time that we're living in? What do you think may never be the same again?
You know, Rose, I call it the new new. I don't think we are ever going back to the way that we were. It used to be that we used to talk about innovation that was going on in garages across the country. Well, that innovation is now in homes and condos and apartments. That innovation revolves around the connectivity with social media and new communications network. Ideas are flowing back and forth. Now, there are certain sectors that will completely change. And the reason for that is, regardless of this pandemic, automation continues. Technology advancements continue. We're going to see, and before our eyes, I think, new pathways and innovations that are ongoing in transportation. How we think about connecting with respect to the consumption of entertainment, my sense is that will change too. You'll see the emergence, I believe, of virtual and augmented reality systems that will change the ways in which we converse and connect and communicate. We're not going back in certain places, but we will go back to a time where we'll be able to physically connect again. I'm very excited about the new news around the vaccines that are coming out and eventually, you know, being able to provide those vaccines for the world. So that some things do return to some degree of normalcy, but we won't go back to where we were before.
And I think so many people are looking forward to that in our community. So.
I agree.
Anything else you want to add before we wrap up today?
There are not many opportunities to say thank you to your professors and to your schools that play such an important role in shaping who you are. And Princeton has done that for me. It has been instrumental in shaping who I am. Professors, my deans during that period of time, the other students. It was a wonderful time of my life. I learned so much about not only the subjects I took, but myself as well. And I just wanted to take this time to appreciate all of them and thank them very much. I am forever grateful.
I'm sure they're thanking you as well. Well, thank you so much, Rob. This was a great conversation. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. Just delighted to.
You've been listening to Changemakers, a podcast produced by the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. This show is hosted, produced, and edited by me, Rose Huber. Listen and subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, and wherever else you find podcasts. Thanks for tuning in and see you next time.